Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Oh my, are we ready for a little mystery? Absolutely, good. My name is Michael Wallenfels. I am here with the University Bookstore, and we're thrilled to partner with the Seattle Public Library to present Mr. Spencer Quinn this evening. So I'm going to get right into it. Spencer Quinn has been described by Stephen King as being fluent in two languages, suspense and dog. So if there are any dog owners in the audience, he'll be happy to speak with your furry companion after the event. Mr. Quinn has taken Chet and Bernie on several adventures, and doggone it, thereby hangs a tale to fetch a thief and the dog who knew too much. So without any further ado, here to read and speak about A Fistful of Collars, please welcome Spencer Quinn.
Thank you for that very nice introduction. Thank to all of you for coming. We're going to talk about A Fistful of Collars, fifth book in the Chet and Bernie mystery series. But I thought we'll start it with I'll sink very low down, and I'll tell a cute baby story about myself. A writer can't really go, you know, much lower than that. I mean, you know, parents or grandparents tell cute baby stories about their, but no one tells a cute baby story about himself. There's one level actually lower than that, so we'll digress off this digression, and then we'll get to the talk, I promise. The lowest thing a writer can do, in my opinion, is quote from his own reviews. I was brought up not to do that. The first time I saw it happen, I was down at an American Library Association event in South Florida, and they had these writers on stools on a stage. If you ever organize an event like that, don't put writers on stools. Their sense of balance is generally not good, and they often drink too much. Anyway, I'm on a stool. The writer next to me is on a stool. And all of a sudden, he starts quoting from his own reviews, and I was stunned because I'd been brought up never to do a thing like that. And then as I listened more closely, I could tell if you knew anything about reviews, his weren't even that good. You could hear the dot, dot, dots going by, you know, where he took out the qualifiers. I only quote from one review that I've had in a fairly long career in many, many reviews. A number of years ago, I was asked if I would write for children. Now, the Chet and Bernie mystery series are adult books, but I'm glad to see that a lot of teenage kids and even somewhat younger are reading them. But I was asked if I'd be interested in writing for children, and I did. And before the first book came out, it was in the Echo Falls mystery series, which are, you know, crime novels for kids is really what they were. And the HarperCollins publicist, Harper Children, said, "Would you be willing to go into the schools?" And I said, well, yeah, that's where the kids are, you know, held captive, right, is, you know, where I can get. And they said, well, you know, think about it. A lot of our writers don't like to go into the schools. And I said, oh, why not? And she said, they're not that comfortable around kids. Okay, these are children's book writers. I said, I have four of my own. Send me into the schools. So on the first tour for a book called Down the Rabbit Hole, which is the first in the series, I was out in the Midwest somewhere, and I went into this school, and these books were they're middle school books for fifth to eighth grade. But at this particular school, a teacher came up to me before the talk, and she said, we have some gifted third graders who've read your book. Can they come to the talk? And I said, sure, because I wanted to see, you know, what gifted third graders look like. So, having never been one myself. And so, at the end of the talk, up come five gifted third graders. These are tiny creatures. And the red-haired one with freckles looked up at me and he said, I read your book. It was pretty good. Pretty good is the only review I quote. And it comes from like a certified gifted reviewer. Very few writers, you know, can say that. Okay, that was a digression. Now we're going to get back to the cute baby story, right? And then we'll get to A Fistful of Collars, I promise. It's not really a cute baby story. It's a cute toddler story because I was 4 years old at the time. I just learned this from my dad within the last year or so, this story. I was at a preschool. I went to preschool, 4 years old. And every day at this preschool, we went for a walk. But on this particular day, it was raining outside, so we still went for the walk, but indoors. So we're walking, but everything's imaginary. So, for example, the teacher would say, okay, now we're at a stoplight. It's a red light. And we'd all clomp to a stop. Okay. Do you see where I'm going with this? So we're walking, and the teacher said, okay, here's the puddle. And all the class walked around the puddle. Except for me, I walked right through the puddle. And the teacher said, what about the puddle? And I said, I've got boots on. When my mother came to pick me up, and my mother was a writer and taught me almost everything I know about writing when I was a kid. When my mother, I'll digress onto that and then we'll get to the talk. And when my mother came to pick me up, the teacher told her this story. And my mother knew she had the prototypical writer. Antisocial, attention-seeking, disruptive. All the main pillars were in place. It just needed a little refining. Okay. So, and now I'll get to my mother and how she taught me to write, and then we'll get to the talk, if there's any time, and it's going to be dicey. But I really should mention my mother, because she really did teach me how to write when I was, probably before I was 12 years old. I didn't learn anything formally after that that she hadn't already put me onto. Back, this was a long time ago when I went to school. It was before the invention of the five-paragraph essay. The two-paragraph essay was in its early stages of development at this time. So do you know the five-paragraph essay? That's what we use to torment our children with now. You know, we have to learn it for the PSATs and the SATs. The five-paragraph essay. Well, this is before that. Do you know the five-paragraph essay and how difficult? You know, okay, we'll digress. And if Eileen is still in here, no, she's gone. You know Guantanamo? Oh, and this is a good town for this. You know Guantanamo? I don't ever get into politics, but I'm on a book tour right now, and I was in Phoenix, and a very nice lady escorted me. And just casually toward the end, she told me that she was in Sheriff Joe's posse. Which, you know, so anyway, but she didn't tase me or anything like that. So this was... I've been thinking about Guantanamo. You know, there are these allegations that these prisoners have been abused and tortured and things like that. We just don't have enough imagination in how we handle this kind of thing. If every morning when those prisoners woke up, you took them into the dining hall and handed each of them a blue book, one of those blue exam books, and said to them, okay, today we're writing another five-paragraph essay. They would have folded so long ago, you know, and told us every possible secret, but we don't imagine. Anyway, before the five-paragraph essay, we did a lot of writing in my school, but it was anything we wanted, not a structured thing. And so I love adventure stories, and I would write little adventure stories. I wrote a little adventure story every week for 2 years, just for fun. It didn't seem like work. They were adventure stories. And all I can remember from this period, none of these have survived, of course, thank God. But I remember the first line, one that began, the archaic telephone jangled shrilly in the murky tropical night. And that was followed by five unintelligible pages about some adventure in the Amazon jungle to which I'd been no closer to the zoo in Boston. But I'd bring this little story home to my mother, and she'd look at it and she'd say, wow, the phone jangled shrilly. Do you need shrilly? Isn't jangled have shrilly in it? And I'd say, yeah. To this day, very few adverbs in my work. The archaic telephone, she'd say. Is archaic exactly the right word? No, it's just frustratingly close. She wouldn't tell me what the right word is. I would have to figure it out. She would tell me there'd be a list of words never to use. They were almost always connecting words. However, nevertheless, to be sure. If you're a reader of the New York Times, there's an epidemic of to be sures racing like a contagion from one reporter to another right now, and there's no editor in place anymore to stop it. My mother said, sentences should connect through the force of the ideas connecting. And if you find yourself using a lot of connecting words, maybe the ideas aren't. Okay? Do you see the way? So I had all the, and then the building blocks of my career. No boilerplate ever. Bend every note. Don't ever do anything the way it's been done before. Just this originality. It was like a religion. And I don't know how much of it is natural to me or how much was formed when I was so young. It's just like the same as being natural. So I owe her a great debt. One of the saddest things in my life is that she died, I would say, 3 or 4 months before I got the idea for my first book. And she never, none of this, she never knew any of this. But maybe she would have thought they were lousy. You don't know. Okay, so let's get to the Chet and Bernie mystery series. One day in 2008, my wife said, "You should do something with dogs." Now, in a lot of my previous work, there had been dogs, but you always saw them from the outside. These books were all written in third person close. You were never inside the dog. One of the interesting things about this career of being a novelist is that sometimes 6 months worth of work can happen in 30 seconds. The opposite is also true, so don't go plunging into being a writer anytime soon. If you can do anything else and get a weekly paycheck, I would advise you to do that. So within the first 30 seconds of my wife telling me this, I knew that I wanted to write a story that was narrated by a dog. And then I also knew the most crucial thing about this whole series. This dog was not going to be a human being in a dog suit. This dog was not going to be able to talk. This dog knows nothing about Mozart. It was going to be as purely a canine narrator as I could get. And anyone who knows and loves dogs knows that inside their brain is a narrative going on. There's a narrative in that brain. I wanted to get that on the page as purely as I could. In what kind of story? I love crime fiction. I've dedicated my career to it. I love the traditional private eye novel that's told in the first person by the sidekick. Now, let's not for the moment get into an argument about who the sidekick is in the Chet and Bernie mystery. But these go right back to Holmes and Watson, right? Arthur Conan Doyle, where Dr. Watson tells the story in the first person. And the tone is so great. And even though he's just telling the story and isn't really the active figure, it's Watson in many ways who makes those books work. Okay, I knew within 30 seconds all of what I've just told you. We live in Massachusetts on a salt marsh, and there's a garage. And over the garage it's a detached garage, and over the garage is the room where I write. So I have like a 15-foot commute. But it's important psychologically. So right after you guys be my wife. She has just said, I'm just finishing dessert. She has just said this. I walked over to the office. I sat down at my desk. I wrote the first page of what became Doggone It, which is the first book in the series. I took it back into the house, into the kitchen, showed it to her. We voted 2-0 that it worked. Which, it was very lucky the kids weren't home, because we could have lost a 4-2 crusher, and none of this ever would happen. When I handed it in to my agent, she was very enthusiastic, and she said, this is not going to be the kind of thing where, we're going to be struggling to find a publisher. But it's so different from all your previous work, which was always written in the third person, never had a dog narrator, and was also darker. She said there's humor in your previous work. She said that generously, but it's chillier, and this is broader. And then she said something really interesting. She said, this is actually more like you. So let's go back to I've Got Boots On. Do you see a little bit of Chet, maybe, in that? Do you remember that story I told, or is that too long ago to call up in the memory bank? It's just on my very edge, actually. I almost lost it. So, and at that point, she said, let's use a pen name. No, it won't be a state secret. Well, first of all, in the United States, we can't keep them very well. We're not designed for that. But it won't be a state secret. But we'll just brand it differently, because I think it'll help find the audience that's out there. And she was right, as she is about, you know, so many things. All right. Some very good things have happened out of this series that I want to get to before, if there's time, and I don't think there will be, for the tap dancing part of the program. But one is, before the first book, Dog Anna, came out, the publisher said, would you be willing to do some social media? And after they explained what that was, I said I'd take a swing at it. So there's a blog called ChetTheDog.com. There, Chet is at Facebook on ChetTheDog and also on Twitter. Very nice things have happened because of these. One thing is that people began to send in photos. If you go to ChetTheDog.com or the Facebook page, there are literally, in four figures, lots and lots of photos. By the way, not just dogs. There are cats, there are birds, there are hamsters, and there's more than one stuffed animal. So they're in the Friends of Chet Gallery, and as these began to pile up, I said to my editor, you know, why don't we have a contest where a random number generator every month picks a winner who's friend of the month, and that winner gets displayed prominently for the month, and the winner's human companion gets a signed copy of the latest book. So we do that now, and the random number generator, if I can get it working, does that on the last day of every month. So if you go to ChetTheDog.com or the Facebook page, you'll see all these, and you can send in your own. I will say this, but it can't go beyond these four walls. And that is that sometimes, let's say someone at a signing like this happens to mention the name of a dog to me, and later I look and see the dogs that are coming in, I'm in position to put my thumb on the scale a little bit. That can't get outside these four walls, all right? And there's another thing I'll tell you later that also is a total secret. So, two other great things happened. One is, and this is the second best thing that ever happened in my whole career. Do you know the way you can make a quilt where one person makes one patch and another, and then an expert makes it all into a big... Okay, without telling me, a group at the blog... You know, so tons of people come to the blog. Out of those, and the numbers are quite big, but out of those, there's also a group who've become known as the Plunderers. They're from all over the place, and they've formed real, genuine attachments, and I think lots of them have never met. But when I meet them, and they come to these events wearing a Chet the Dog ID, everyone gets a hug. So without telling me, the Plunderers made one of these quilts. It's all about the Chet and Bernie mystery series. It's a work of art, like with bones and baseballs. It hangs in my office in a prominent place. And in fact, when I get home at the end of the tour, I've posted the picture of it a few times, but I'll put it on again. That's the second best thing that ever happened in my whole career. At this point, sometimes people say, what was the first best? But since no one did, we won't. No, it's way too late for that. The other thing that happened, and this is pretty cool, and I think the way I remember this, there's a kennel in Alaska called the Snowhook Kennel that runs a team of huskies in the Iditarod race. You know the big sled dog race every year? And it's run by two wonderful people, AJ and Rebecca. And I think it was Rebecca found Dog on it and read it and really liked it and sent in a comment. So these other people at the blog got to know her. And now ChetTheDog.com and these people at the blog help raise money for Snowhook Kennel to run every year in that race, and they have auctions to raise money for them. Quite a lot, because it's very expensive to keep all those dogs and pay the entry fee. And so Snowhook Kennel run, and they're ChetTheDog.com patches that the musher wore for that race. Before I signed on to that, though, I wanted to make sure that they were a humane... I didn't want the kind of athletes who... where the musher would say, okay, that dog's not feeling too, or he's limping a little bit, but we're going to tough it out, you know, like a high school coach in Texas. I wanted the kind of musher who said, okay, we're stopping until this is sorted out. These people have won at least one prize, for the humanitarian prize in one of these races. They're loving to their dogs, and the dogs come first. So I signed on. So that's the Snowhook Kennel story. We still haven't gotten to a fistful of collars. And before we do, I won't, unless someone asks at the very end, I won't tell the very best thing that ever happened. We'll get to A Fistful of Collars. A Fistful of Collars is the fifth book in the Chet and Bernie mystery series. An obvious question is, do you have to read them in order? That's the kind of question that would never occur to Chet, right? You plunge in at any time. Oh, and I should say, you know, I haven't even mentioned Bernie yet. Bernie is the detective. Chet is the dog who tells the story in the first person. That was sentence one. We're going to start the talk all over, okay? And everybody has to come in the room again.
So what was the best thing you ever
did? No, we're not. No, we can't get to that. It was too late. No, that's too late. So you can read them in any order. You can read these in any order. Having said that, there is growth and character development and things like that, but they're still designed to be read in any order. So, yes, ma'am. Yes, but there are, yes, that's really interesting. It's when you write a long series, and this is going to be quite a bit longer. Thank you. You get to, there's so much you can do. For example, last night, I was in San Diego, and the publisher sent four Chet and Bernie Frisbees. Have you seen those orange Frisbees? Yes, but they didn't send any here. Anyway, there were only four, and there were lots of people. So the bookstore, people said, could you do a quiz? And then the winners of the, so I made up a quick quiz, and one of the questions was, what can you tell me about the title bomb divorce? Does that ring a bell, the title bomb divorce? It's mentioned in most of the books. It was one of the most, Chet and Bernie hate divorce work, and the title bomb divorce was just a horrendous case that Chet can't get out of his mind. Whenever he's thinking about the worst cases they've had, it always comes up. And then a new detail is revealed about what happened to the title bomb divorce, and each time it's something a little different. What happened, I think one of the things that happened was Chet says, would he ever forget the sight of Mrs. Teitelbaum in the bulldozer inside the warehouse where Mr. Teitelbaum kept his antique car collection, you know, when things were going bad, and she crushed all his. So the Teitelbaum divorce was a nightmare, except at the end, that's when Chet, for the first time, tasted kosher chicken. So it had a silver lining. And see, one of the things about Chet, these are not cozies, these books. They have darkness in them. They have a noirish aspect. Chet can suffer. He can feel pain. What else he can do, though, is he can come back, he can bounce back to his reset position quite quickly, and that reset position is one of optimism. I'm not like that, but this is, now we're on a very weird digression. I'm not like that, but having written this character, I've become a little more like that. Isn't that weird that a figment of your own imagination can change the way you look at life? You tell me, right? As Chet would say. So if you went to MFA, and really learned how to write, you would learn metafiction, you know, the characteristics, you know, tools of metafiction. The other thing is, Chet's an unreliable narrator. the classic mystery novel, and this is something mystery writers have made hay on from the very beginning, the classic mystery novel, the plot of it mirrors the solving of a real criminal case. It involves following a logical chain of clues to the deduction that makes sense. Well, Chet can't do that. Even if he could, just at the moment when some important clue was about to walk on the page, he might sniff a Cheeto under the couch. And so that clue is never there. That makes him a totally unreliable narrator. Also, a cutting-edge literary technique. To marry the unreliable narrator to the mystery form is actually sort of interesting. okay, now we're, you know, now we're in the gears that make this go boring for everybody. So we'll at last get on to, but I think he's the most unreliable narrator in fiction. But on everything where it counts, he's totally reliable, I think, anyway. All right, let's get to A Fistful of Cards, fifth book in the series. Chet and Bernie live in a place that Chet knows of as the Valley. It's not the San Fernando Valley. And whenever I'm near L.A., of course, oh, he lives in the San Fernando. No, he doesn't. If you know Phoenix at all, you know there they refer to it as the Valley, and Phoenix is in a valley. It isn't exactly Phoenix either. I mean, it's like a combination of Phoenix and Tucson with a little something else. But it's totally, yes, it's Arizona. But I wanted a place where there's a huge urban area, but next to it a vast wilderness within easy access. Because a dog is part wild, and there's a wildness that can never be gotten rid of, and maybe in us too. But I wanted him to have access because I knew there could be scenes out there. And all those scenes in my mind were often going to be big scenes. You know, when you're a writer and you don't do outlines like me, but if you know that there are a few big scenes to come, they're like lighthouses on the way. And if you know, for example, has anyone read To Fetch a Thief where they search for a missing elephant? Okay, and I knew that later in that book, about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through, Chet and the elephant named Peanut would be alone together out in the wilderness, and Chet would have to somehow get in control of this elephant. Wait, that's like a lighthouse for a writer. I knew if I can get... That's coming. I knew when it came that it was meaty stuff. So I don't need the outline. I just need to know a few of these places where I'm going to get to. Okay, Chet and Bernie live in the valley. And Chet just knows it as the valley. Although in book six... And here's another digression. Why I'm talking about book six right now. In book six, book six begins. Chet and Bernie are out driving in the Porsche. Why am I doing this? I've got. This is five. No, I'm writing six. Yeah, six comes out next September, and so I'll be. So I shouldn't be mentioning this. Don't say to my publisher that this happened. Yes, I write one a year. Oh, I'll get to that. I shouldn't get to that, but there is no name yet. We're not there yet. Anyway, I shouldn't. Yes, no, but it's not. That's not the problem. The problem. No, the problem is I can't. I don't have time to tell you this, but I will anyway. So, Chet and Bernie are out driving in a Porsche, and they come upon one of those road crews that's made up of prisoners wearing. Orange jumpsuits, exactly. The prisoners are wearing orange jumpsuits, so when Chet and Bernie see that when they're on the road, they always slow down because they might know somebody, okay? And they, in this case, they do. They know Frenchie Boutet, and they have a little chat with Frenchie. Now, he's called Frenchie in the West, but he's a Cajun from New Orleans and the Bayou country, and he's a member of a black sheep, big black sheep Bayou family that has one white sheep member. And that white sheep member is Ralph, and he's gone missing. And so Frenchie wants to hire Bernie. Well, you know, and Chet to find him. Well, Bernie and Chet just go home. I mean, he's a prisoner, right? He's not carrying money. But that night, his wife, Frenchie's wife, Vanna, who actually has another career that you wouldn't think of a wife having, let's just leave it at that, comes to their house and hands them the retainer plus a bonus of $3,000. Chet notices that the money smells of shrimp. They go out to Louisiana. And when they're in Louisiana, I'm still talking about the Arizona thing, that's what this digression is about, they meet a sheriff, and so Bernie hands him the little detective agency card. And the sheriff reads it, and he says, oh, you're from Arizona. And Chet says, ha, I'd wondered about that. So in book six of the series, Chet will finally know. So anyway, and then one more digression, and we're back to the real thing. And the test after when you leave isn't going to be on the digressions. It will be on A Fistful of Cards. So I told my editor where the story was going to take place, and he said, here's the title. Did someone just ask about a title? Here's the title, he said. It's going to take place in New Orleans in the Bayou Country. I said, yes. A Doghouse Named Desire. But it's It's not written in stone yet. Okay, so A Fistful of Collars. Let's get back to A Fistful of Collars. In A Fistful of Collars, the mayor of the valley wants to attract Hollywood production companies to come to the valley and make movies. I mean, you know this happens in other states, you know, non-Southern California. In my own home state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is trying to attract movie business. They actually attracted I'm not going to call him a friend of mine, although I know him. They'll call him a non-friend. And
acquaintance,
yeah. He's more like a non-friend. who made some movies. Here's the way it works. You come up with a budget. So let's say you spend $100,000 on props. You hand that receipt into the government, and you get a tax credit for that amount. Those tax credits can be bought and sold just like air rights by a Manhattan real estate developer. Yes, you can sell them to Citibank or American Express at less than the... But you can sell... So this non-friend of mine, that's how he financed the movies. He sold... That was all the money there was. With one added twist, and that is... For example, there was an actor, he's a very well-known actor, but I won't mention his name. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts received documentation that this actor got $2 million for the role. What he actually got were $400,000. The difference, $1.6 million, was pocketed by my non-friend. To make this work, he had also to file, without the knowledge of my non-friend, a 1040 reporting, in other words, a false 1040. So... My non-friend is now breaking rocks in the hot sun. And he is not going to do well at Massachusetts Correctional Institute up in Walpole. He's not designed for that. Anyway, that's a digression. We had no time for it. Oh, we'll get to the movie in a minute. No. It's the mayor's trying to attract the movie business, and he actually attracts a major production company, and they're going to come to the valley, and they're going to make this sort of retro western. And of course, Bernie's very interested in that because his family has lived in that part of Arizona for generations. Bernie owned the whole area, all around Mesquite Road. His family did, and that whole part of the canyon. Now it's just the one house. And their most valuable possession is his great-grandfather's watch, which is hawked, I think, it was at the pawn shop in every book in the series when their finances get bad. The mayor has succeeded in getting these people. The star of the picture is this huge Hollywood action star named Thad Perry, who's a huge star, but he's a very troublesome guy. He's a drunk and a brawler and a drugger and a womanizer and has torn up many movie sets. The mayor is worried that he will sink this ship before it even gets going. So he hires Chet and Bernie to babysit this troublesome star, Thad Perry, while he's in the valley. And it turns out that Thad Perry has a past. The scene I usually read, but there won't be time tonight, is the boxing scene. So when you get to it, when... Thad Perry is staying in this huge mansion in a sort of camelback mountain kind of place, and Chet and Bernie are there waiting for him, Thad arrives by helicopter, and this enormous retinue comes off the helicopter, and the very last person, and the very last flunky is carrying an enormous cat named Brando, and Chet knows right then that this is going to be a very difficult case, but he's going to have to find an accommodation with Brando. Inside the house, Thad Perry, he's big and ripped and muscular. You know, a lot of these Hollywood action stars spend a lot of time in the gym. It's even possible they take performance-enhancing bodybuilding drugs. You know, like NFL players are not allowed to. Like in the NFL, you know, they test you, and if you know, you're banned. But in Hollywood, I mean, let's say, just to name an actor, Sylvester Stallone, I'm not saying anything about him, but let's say he tested positive for HGH, human growth hormone, or steroids. You know, they wouldn't say, okay, he tested positive, we can't release the movie. You know, that's not going to happen. So Thad Perry is this big, ripped guy, and he's a friend of the middleweight champion of the world, middleweight boxing champion of the world. And the middleweight, like these Hollywood actors get a lot of sycophants around them, you know, people sucking up to them. And the middleweight champion has told them, oh, if you'd only started boxing young, you'd be a champion now too. So Fat is in the ring a lot, shadow boxing, and there's a ring at this house, and Fat is in it. And the boxing scene begins with Fat shadow boxing. He's this big, ripped guy. He's got a huge bodyguard named Jiggs, and Chet and Bernie are watching. And Thad Perry starts goading Bernie to come into the ring and fight and spar with him. And Bernie resists and resists. And finally, it would be unmanly. And he gets into the ring with Thad Perry. And that's when the boxing scene starts. But that also brings us to the end of the unprepared remarks for tonight. And I'm now, first of all, thank you so much. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, I didn't put up checks. Thank you. I'm a member of the Free Iggy Society. Poor Iggy just jumping up and down in front of that window. And he's just his friend. And the one time he got to go and play in Iggy's house did not work out well for the soap. So what I want to know is,
yes,
at the very least, can Iggy come over and have a play date with Chet? And possibly, could Iggy even get to ride along and jump up and down?
Okay, just for background to people who don't know, Iggy is Chet's best friend, and he lives next door with an old infirm couple called the Parsons. And one day an electric fence salesman came into the neighborhood, and it confused the Parsons, and Iggy no longer goes out. Chet and Iggy used to play all the time. We only now see Iggy in his window like this, except in The Dog Who Knew Too Much, the previous book. And that was the scene I read last year on the road.
Doesn't he get hot dogs?
What?
Doesn't he get really good food that Chet's jealous of?
Oh, that Chet is seen through the window. Oh, yes. Oh, Chet saw him get, oh, absolutely, in the gold foil pack. Oh, yeah. But once Chet got in there, and that happened in The Dog Who Knew Too Much. Anyway, all these things I've thought of. When you're writing a long series and you have some of these things in your back pocket, like Iggy gets in my back pocket, there's no compulsion to pull him out really fast. But we're certainly going to be, because there's this big cast of characters to work with now. But Iggy, I enjoyed the moment of, you couldn't call it freedom, but at least companionship in The Dog Who Knew Too Much when they ruined the plumbing that day. And there'll certainly be more of Iggy. Yes, ma'am.
So I'm really interested in the puppy. I love the way you introduced the puppy.
Look alike.
Do we get to see him again?
The puppy. At the end of...
And then, not to be too politically correct, but shouldn't Chet get leader?
Well, you know, here's... To me, that's like saying, shouldn't Paul Newman get neuter? I mean, he's the star of the show. I believe that people should really be responsible dog owners, and I am myself in that area. Just... Please just allow me the latitude in this one thing not to do that to him. Okay, the puppy.
And thank goodness he's not.
No, at the end of book one, doggone it, although no one, there's a backyard, there's a patio, and there's a high fence, a gate behind it. And at least for the first few books in the series, no one realizes that Chet is capable of leaping that high. But at the end of that book, there's she barking that he hears on the other side of the canyon, and he does leap that high, and that's how book one, doggone it, ended. Well, a couple books later, this puppy who looks a lot like Chet started getting spotted in the canyon. And that's pretty much all we know. And he's been, and Mr. Parsons got a picture of him and has shown it to Bernie. So, yes, there'll be more of the puppy. I have to go behind the scenes again, I have to make up my mind exactly who the human companion of that puppy is and what I'm going to do with that.
So
there's something about him in here. Yeah, I believe there is. There's something about him in here. Yeah.
How did you come to the title for A Fistful of Collars?
For A Fistful of Collars, I sent in a list. It might have been on it. And it might not have. There was also someone at my agent's office who liked it. I haven't done every title myself. I've done some. I did Thereby Hangs a Tale.
I liked it.
Thank you. But, you know, a friend of mine suggested Doggone It. Titles are... I suggest titles every time. But the marketing people come in and they, you know, so, but the fact that you guys all seemed to like A Doghouse Named Desire, yeah. If the marketing people go against me, saying, oh, well, I can say, well, you know, I've been talking to real live readers, you know, and they like it. And that's the one thing you can do to beat the marketing people. So thank you for that.
What kind of dog do you have at home?
I have two dogs at home. One is Audrey, who's she's 7 years old. She's half Bernese and half Golden. She's pretty much a wild animal, sleeps outside at all times, an unbelievable guard dog. And then there's Pearl, who's a one-year-old Golden Retriever of the very white kind. And she's getting by on looks alone, still, at this point. Yes?
You need to get a pug.
I need to get a pug. Please don't let my wife know that, because then a pug will appear. We tend to attract dogs very easily.
We have connections at Pug Rescue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. No, I know it's not going to be a big problem, the actual getting of it. Yeah. Were there others? Yes, ma'am.
This is your pen name, right?
Oh, yeah, because remember I mentioned in the talk that my agent thought a pen name would be...
So have you written other books by another name?
Oh, yes, I have. Many. Many.
What's the other name?
The other name is Peter Abrahams.
Abrahams?
Yes. What? Well, my real name, let's not get... Yes, that's... You know, I'm starting to like Spencer Quinn better. You know, he's a cooler guy. And, yeah, so I've written many... Oh, yeah, I didn't just jump into this at this point. I've written... I think 17 standalone crime fiction books, each different.
Under Peter.
Yes, absolutely. One was made into a movie called The Fan. Robert De Niro played The Fan, and who just died? Tony Scott was the director.
The Fan.
Yeah, but many, a lot. Oblivion is another one. The New Yorker wrote a long piece about Oblivion and End of Story, and which actually Stephen King said it's a primer on writing disguised as a crime novel. He said. Anyway, forget all that. That's so close to quoting a review. I should cut my head off. Okay, it's over. Thanks for coming.
You've been...
What?
How did you come up with the name of Chet?
Oh, that's a good question. How did I come up with the name of Chet? You know, I can't write a character until I've got the name. That's the thing that slows me down more than any. But what? Thank you for that. It just came to me. It was the right sort of name, but I can't tell you exactly how. But names are very important. Yes, ma'am.
I worry about Bernie. It's like, how bad is his drinking problem?
He's a reasonably successful dad, and he's a reasonably successful detective.
Why aren't the this last book, The Dog from the Twins, was not out on CD that I could find. I'm listening to it. I'm listening to the story because I love listening to this story.
You know, the CD, I think it is on audible.com. You can download.
Yeah, no, I've downloaded.
Yeah. But you know, they're doing fewer and fewer CDs. They are doing it for this, I believe. I'm pretty sure. And I have no control over that. I think it's much more expensive for them to do CDs than a download. Of course it is, right? So, but I have no control of that. But I agree with you. He does a good job, yeah.
Yeah, the reader's great.
Were there more? Yes, ma'am.
How did you come up with the character of Bernie? Is he based on someone?
None of mine are based on anybody. And Chet isn't either. But if I hadn't known and loved dogs, I couldn't have written it. No, Bernie's not based on anybody. Yes.
What do you call that genre, kind of a macho detective?
Well, it's a noirish private eye. It's the American style.
Yes,
it goes right back to Dashiell Hammett and all that. And if you're interested in that traditional type of mystery with a human narrator in the first person, in my opinion, the very best are the Ross McDonald series. With Lou Archer as detective, he died a long time ago. They were written.
The comic element of the dog.
Yes, thank you. Well, because that is certainly part of it. Yes, I'm glad you do. The Lou Archer books, there isn't really much in the way of humor, but there's a lovely humanity in them that I like, and a great environmental sense of Southern California. Were there others?
Speaking of the environment, that's something I really enjoy in the books. The Bernie cares so very much about what's going on.
Yes, thank you. And he, you know, and he worries about the aquifer, and Chet whenever they go past a golf course, as happens when you're in Phoenix, or, you know, the spray. And Bernie says, I mean, Chet thinks to himself, we have water out the yin yang. You know, it's coming out of the ground, so there's nothing to worry about. Yes, ma'am.
Which authors do you read?
I read all kinds of things, actually. I mean, I don't read much fiction anymore. I'm a big fan of Graham Greene and a bunch of others. The last book I read was a Hitchcock biography, just because I'm interested in Hitchcock. Were there others? Yes, sir.
How difficult was it to shop this to your agent? I mean, it's such a different perspective.
Well, you know, if you in this business, the agent is a very important person in the career now, because the editors come and go. I've had the same agent for a long, long time, and she's an excellent, excellent agent. And it was she read one page and knew she wanted it. So it wasn't difficult to sell it to her at all. So she liked it, even though it was different. She's on the lookout for different. Different is good.
How old were you when you wrote your first published book?
I was 32 years old. Before that, I had worked as a spear fisherman in the Bahamas, and I worked a bit in radio. I did a lot of traveling, just bumming around the world. I crossed the Sahara Desert in a Volkswagen bus once. I wouldn't do that today. Here I go. I'll just go through Mali and see what happens. Here's my U.S. passport. It's okay. Were there any other questions? Yes.
So how did you get to know that part of the world? I've never been to that part.
The Southwest?
Yes.
Oh, I've done a lot of traveling and hiking now. I love it. I love the Southwest. So, yes.
Is it a movie?
Oh, the movie. I don't know.
Okay.
But there's doggone it. Okay, this is another thing, not beyond these four walls. And this is a little story that's going to show you how naive I am. But you can't repeat this, okay? And it can't get out of here. A major production company, yeah, I'll put everything in disguise. That's what I'm going to do. A major production company optioned, that's what they do. It's like a rental. They optioned Doggone It before it came out, and they got a major studio involved. Okay, so that's what you want right away. You want that studio because that's the money. It's not actually the studio. It's Wall Street has the money, and the studio gets it from Wall Street. That's the way the movie business works. So they had the studio, and they hired a screenwriter who was very well known, and he wrote a screenplay. For whatever reason, maybe because it was during the period where finally, just as the option was about to expire, and everyone said it's on the fast track, someone at the studio high up read this screenplay and stopped it, gave it the red light, put it in turnaround, as they say in Hollywood. So the producers came to me and said, well, we're going to need more time on the option. And I said, okay, now I would like to, before I do that, take that step, could I see the screenplay? I thought at that point I had a right to see the screenplay. So I saw the screenplay. And a conversation ensued, the result of which was they hired me to write a new version of the screenplay, which I did. And I based it on To Fetch a Thief, actually, because I thought it was the most cinematic of the books that had been done to that point. And so now they're shopping it. They're looking for directors, actors, a studio. So I got an email a couple weeks ago saying, the producers are going to take a meeting. They take meetings, they don't have them. They're going to take a meeting that's kind of a little bit outside the box, because the WWF wants to maybe finance it and put in one of their stars. So I emailed back, are you talking about the World Wildlife Fund? Of course it's the World Wrestling Federation, right? So that's how naive I am. So I can't really tell you where we are in the movie beyond that, okay? That really has to be it for the questions, because thank you very much.
This- This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.